Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 237 of Registry Matters. Good evening, fine sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm very well. You made it another week.
Isn't that amazing?
It is pretty amazing. Speaking of you made it another week, somebody else didn't quite make it another week. Do you have anything to say?
Someone who didn't make it another week.
Yeah, well, that would be the Queen.
Well,
Charles is probably upset.
She only made it 96 years.
But, well, in pre-show, we talked about the reign of leadership, whatever. Like, there was a pope that made it how long?
28 days.
That's not very long. That is not very long at all.
Yes, we were testing my memory and nobody Googled it. So I think he lasted 28 days. I think he was proclaimed Pope in 78, and I think his name was John Paul I.
I think so?
He originated from Poland. So,
are we talking about like in the 1800s, the first, or when roughly? Is this somewhere in your tenure of life?
We're talking about 1978.
Oh, that's not that long ago.
Yep.
I was even a hatchling by then.
So, yeah, so he preceded the John Paul II, who lasted quite some time.
Right, and he's the one that, like the modern era, like he was almost like the queen as far as he was there for forever, and he ended up with like the Pope-mobile with the little bubble over his, in his vehicle, I believe, because there was an assassination attempt on him, I believe.
That is correct. You have a great memory.
Well, tell me what we are going to do tonight, sir.
Well, we're going to offer some condolences for someone who was lost in a prison in North Carolina, I think just yesterday. We're going to play some audio video clips from YouTube. And we're going to take a question from one of our long-term listeners. And we've got an analysis to do of that question that's pretty thorough.
Okay.
And we've got a great decision from the Ninth Circuit that illustrates what's wrong with the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996.
Man. All right. Well, sounds like we're going to have a great show ahead of us. And before we get going too far on this, I think I will say make sure that you go over to the YouTubes and press the like and subscribe and hit the bell to notify, and that'll start spreading the FYP Registry Matters juice all over the place. And that's definitely what we want to have happen, isn't it?
It is indeed. And we picked up in the last episode, I think, at least 15 or 20 new YouTube subscribers, which is an unusual high number for us.
Well, considering that the title of it, I wouldn't say it was like super clickbaity, but it was definitely like the amazing defeat or whatever I wrote as far as the title goes. Crushing defeat in Pennsylvania.
Well, I'm sure that caused some people to click, but it was a crushing defeat. It really was.
I agree. And so that generated a lot of buzz and a lot of traffic. So anyway, I appreciate it. So make sure that you share the podcast and tell everyone you know. I did. I'll give you a quick update on this that maybe I should save till the end. But I contacted Securus or whomever is running the tablet stuff in the prison. And I've had minor email conversations back and forth. And I did get a reply and they said, go over here and do it. So maybe we'll end up in prisons. Maybe. That would be pretty big. I think that would be super significant for us to get to the PFR community that is still locked up and get them listening to the podcast.
Well, that would be so awesome because we are looking at the transcription service as far as the distribution arm, the printing. We'll always be doing the transcript for the website. But since the circulation is at such a low level, we may have to reevaluate the viability of that. So it'd be great if they could actually listen.
Absolutely. So first up on the roster would be that this last minute news came in, and it is Central Prison on lockdown after inmate beat convicted PFR to death. Oh, my God. So this is in North Carolina, right?
Raleigh.
Yes. In Raleigh. And so he was pre-trial? Is that what I read in the article, Larry?
You read it correctly. It's very sad that I'm just going to go ahead and offend the prison audience. You file every writ that you can, and you assert your constitutional rights. And yet, prisons are the most unforgiving places when it comes to respecting anyone's constitutional rights. This man was pre-trial. Now, he did apparently have previous convictions for PFR-type stuff, but he was put in a prison because the county didn't think they could keep him safe, and he was beaten. His name, well, let's make, don't leave him nameless. His name is Ronald Rhodes, and he was beaten by other inmates Friday morning in the recreation yard, according to North Carolina Department of Public Safety. I guess all we can do is what is standardly done is thoughts and prayers to the family, but I'm really, really upset about this.
I completely understand. So, I mean, is there anything else besides this?
We don't really know much other than this, but I found it so sad that of all places, when someone comes into a prison or a jail, particularly, which is what he was in for, was for pretrial detention, you should afford them the benefit of the presumption of innocence that our Constitution is supposed to afford everybody. And I say that regardless of the offense, regardless if it's a police officer, regardless if they do something that we see on camera, there may be a defense that's viable. Therefore, they're presumed innocent.
I gotcha. The one thing in here that I wanted to bring up with you is Rose was housed in the prison as a safekeeper at the request of Wake County. And a safekeeper is generally an offender who is housed at a state prison before trial. So I'm going to assume he was not afforded bond and that he is just in pretrial detention type deal, but they have it worded differently.
So, yes, I had not seen that term safekeeping, but that would be not unusual if a local lockup doesn't feel like that based on a high level of community awareness. You can't keep people's stuff secret now in this modern era that we're living in. Therefore, it's difficult to do anything other than try to move them to a facility where hopefully their offense won't be so easily to discern, but this didn't work. He was still
clearly it didn't work. I mean, there is like the chain gang hotline. I mean, all you do is like, hey, this person came in and your family will go look him up and they'll tell you who the person is. And then everything goes to you're just at the whim of everyone in there to do what they want to do to you.
So, well, like I say, I'm sad about it.
All right. Well, then let's move over to this listener question, which is probably going to consume almost the rest of the podcast. And so we have this question that reads, and it's from Moses, as you said. Seriously, Moses? 10 tablets guy? Remember the 10 commandments guy?
Moses is actually the guy's name.
All right. I have a question about the full faith and credit clause in the United States Constitution. If this provision means anything, how can a person be subjected to separate punitive restrictions based on which state they reside? If one migrates to a new state, they are subjected to the laws of that state, which doesn't seem right. Shouldn't each state recognize once one's punishment is completed in another location? This would be similar to one state recognizing other state's driver's license or marriage license. It seems to me that if state A imposes a 10-year period of registration, all other states should be bound by that under the full faith and credit clause. I've been listening to YouTube babble for years now, and I'm confident you will have some way to justify this as being constitutional. All right, so I like this question a lot, including the snark. And would you be so kind, sir, and explain to me what the full faith and credit clause is?
Well, the full faith and credit clause, I'll just read it. The full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And the Congress may, by general laws, prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved and the effect thereof. That's in Article 4, Section 1 of the United States Constitution.
So Article 4, Section 1 of the United States Constitution. And why is that clause there? What does it do? What do it do, man?
Well, I decided to do that research and I went to a reputable source called the Heritage Foundation.
Okay.
The Heritage Foundation would never mislead us.
No.
And they say an essential purpose of the Full Faith and Credit Clause is to assure that the courts of one state will honor the judgments of the courts of another state without the need to retry the whole cause of action. It was an essential mechanism for creating a union out of multiple sovereigns. And again, that's available at the Heritage Foundation's Guide to the Constitution.
All right. So now we'll move on to the issue of registration of offenders and how this clause might be applied. Does this person's theory have any merit? Is one state changing another state's sentence?
Possibly, but it's crucial to understand that many who were registered engaged in the underlying conduct prior to the existence of registration. And by the very nature of that situation, it would be clear that the sentencing court did not order a person to register at the time of the person's sentence was imposed, and certainly did not specify a period of registration per se.
Boy, we could take a whole big detour and talk about the Kennedy Mendoza and it's a civil regulatory scheme, therefore it's not punishment, blah, blah, blah. We could go down that whole path right
We
there.
will get there as this
Okay.
progresses.
All right. Well, then the courts have upheld the retroactive imposition of offenders' registration as a non-punitive civil regulatory scheme. And I thought you have stated repeatedly that regulatory schemes cannot be, or excuse me, can be changed. They can be changed retroactively.
Yes, those truly civil regulatory schemes can be imposed retroactively without violating the ex post facto clause when they're remedial in nature. Unfortunately, most registration schemes as they exist throughout the United States today go far beyond what anyone could be objectively considering as non-punitive.
And does he have a point in terms of those who committed their offense after the existence of registration?
Maybe. Most offenders who engaged in underlying conduct who have been sentenced since the creation of registration schemes generally were apprised by their sentencing court of the duty to comply with offender registration. But this is still not the same thing as having a particular period of time prescribed in the sentencing order.
Have you ever seen a sentence order where the actual registration period was prescribed?
Yes, I actually have. I've seen some rare situations where the sentencing order does prescribe a particular period of registration. And in those situations, the person might have a legitimate legal claim that the order imposed by the court in the original jurisdiction should be final and binding on all states.
In those cases, Larry, were they exceeding or were they reducing the amount of registration?
They were not doing either. They were just putting down on paper how long the person would be required to register. But those were anomalies because as registration, as we have generation one, generation two, as the registries have been enhanced and extended, those practices of putting a particular time in there have long since vanished. But in the early days of registration, when we had much more lenient terms for registration, much shorter terms, I've seen a few that actually included the amount of time that the person would have to register.
Have you seen anybody challenge it when they put the registration obligation there in the sentence?
To my knowledge, there hasn't been any appellate case law, but yes, I have seen in an instance where there was a particular time that the person moved for enforcement of the judgment, but they had not left the original state, and the enforcement of the judgment did occur because it was deemed to be a binding contract and a binding order of the court. It was in the plea agreement, it was a binding order of the court. But the only way to find out if this is a credible argument would be to develop a case asserting the full faith and credit clause.
And so has there been a challenge like that?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. What would you expect such a challenge to be here to be, or if there were one to be brought?
Well, we can be certain that the Attorney General of the state would fight vehemently to extinguish the person's case. They would argue that since the registry is a non-punitive civil regulatory scheme, they can impose their own requirements independent of the state where the underlying conduct occurred. That's just going to be their first line of defense is, this is civil, remedial, and non-regulatory, and we can do this, and we don't care what happened in Georgia. This is not Georgia, this is Iowa.
I still struggle really struggle to find it, unless we're talking about the super easy states where you're not on a public website and there's very little quote unquote disabilities and restraints, how anybody could honestly with integrity say that it is not punishment. There's so many things that go with it that can put you immediately in harm's way.
Well, they can say it because on the last standing order that's precedential in that jurisdiction, if there has been no determination in a jurisdiction that registration is punitive, like, for instance, in my state, there's been no determination that our registry is punitive. So therefore, you can say it with a straight face because the controlling case law is that it's non-punitive.
Gotcha. How would they justify their position since that clause, the full faith and credit clause, seems so clear?
Well, they would cite other examples of civil regulatory requirements that change from state to state. For example, some vehicles are exempt from pollution inspection in sparsely populated states, and that exemption does not transfer to the new state. So that's what they would say. They would say, Your Honor, this is just bogus. I mean, clearly, this is a civil regulatory scheme as far as New Mexico Supreme Court has said, and whatever they may have had in Pennsylvania is irrelevant in our state because ours is not punitive, and therefore we can change it just like we would do on any other civil regulatory scheme. You may have been exempt from paying for a driver's license. You're no longer exempt when you come here or vice versa.
But when you do go to another state, you follow that state's registry stuff, don't you?
That is correct.
Okay. And so then do you think the legislature would get involved if someone filed one of these cases?
I think at some point that very much could happen. Particularly if the argument gained any traction, more states would amend their registration laws to include a clause that imposes the greater of the duration required in the state of conviction or their state. And in fact, there's some states that have already have that clause in their statutory schemes. I come to realize that Iowa has that, and so does Utah.
And so we talk about when almost like a plaintiff shopping. What do you think a good plaintiff for a case like this, who do you think that person would be? What would they, what would their profile be?
Well, the ideal candidate, I think, would be an individual who does have a specified period of registration prescribed in their sentencing order. And then the second best candidate would be a person who had a defined period of registration spelled out in their plea agreement. That person would be in a stronger position to argue that the agreement should be enforced as a binding contract.
And if it was actually in the plea agreement, that person would be in a stronger position to argue that the agreement should be enforced, wouldn't it?
I certainly think they are, because these have been deemed to be contracts. But the situation is a bit murkier because the new state would counter by claiming that they cannot be bound by an agreement made by an official in another jurisdiction, which is what I mentioned earlier, that where there was a particular time, it was enforced in this jurisdiction because it was a contract made by a New Mexico official who was authorized to act on behalf of the state, that being the district attorney or the associate district attorney. But this would indeed be a very unique and interesting legal challenge if someone were to do this. And Moses has really tantalized me with this question.
And while you clear your throat for a minute, so someone in chat says, isn't a driver's license a civil regulatory scheme? So if you go to another state, do you get forced to go get a new driver's license?
You do at some point if you've been in that state long enough. Generally, it's like 30 days. You would have to get a new driver's license if you're going to be there beyond a certain point.
I recall this, and this could have been hearsay, that when I was in the military and I got stationed somewhere, they said that you didn't have to change your driver's license because you had some sort of like you're permanently temporarily there. So you're going to change duty stations in a little while. So why keep making you go change your driver's license? And you just keep your driver's license from your home state through the umpteen hundred years that you're in the military.
There may be such an exception for military.
All right. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover here? It's an interesting question.
It is. I really think that someone may be able to bring such a challenge and we may be able to get some traction.
And Brenda says military is special indeed. Yes, very, very special. It's like short bus special, Brenda?
Short bus special.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, then you also put this case in here from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals named ATDOM, A-T-D-O-M. Why do you put the, like, I can read in some really complicated words, Larry, but this one, Patsalis, ATDOM Patsalis versus David Shin. And it was just a few days ago that the decision came out. And I remember a case that was named May versus Ryan, which later became May versus Shin. Why do so many people sue Mr. Shin?
Well, they sue him in his official capacity as Attorney General of Arizona.
Well, what part of Arizona, and I like as Arona, Arizona is this case from? We just did the clip from, we haven't done the clip from Maricopa County yet.
Yeah, we kind of got out of order. I thought we were going to do that clip first, but anyway.
Oh,
yeah,
then I goofed up. I'm sorry.
But yeah, we can do those later. This is from Mojave County, which I think is Kingman, Arizona.
So what's the issue here? I read it thoroughly and I see no connection, as usual, to PFR issues. You do realize that FYP's time is valuable. Like, I'm on the clock here and, you better bring me some juicy stuff or else I'm shutting you down.
Well, I do recognize our time is valuable, but it does have a connection to PFR issues as it relates to the federal habeas corpus proceedings and the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. And it's very similar to Stephen May's case, which we have discussed on previous episodes.
Can you summarize it in, be brief, Larry, don't use many words, use few words. Can you describe what this case is about?
Sure. Mr. Patsalis, I think is the way you pronounce it, sought federal habeas relief, arguing that his 292-year sentence imposed by an Arizona state court is grossly disproportionate to his crime and constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the federal and Arizona constitution. Is that concise enough?
I suppose. So he was convicted of how many felonies, Larry? I want you to say it.
25.
25 mostly residential burglaries committed against multiple victims over a 3-month period. That is a very active dude to rob 25, I'm assuming, houses or apartments. And it was noted that these were not his first crimes. The trial court imposed consecutive sentences, and consecutive is not concurrent, meaning they got one after the other, on all but two of the 25 counts, resulting in an overall sentence of 292 years. Imprisonment. And can you at least admit that has to be cruel and unusual punishment, Larry?
No, I can't.
All right. So let's give a little bit of some background on the petitioner's case. He committed a series of burglaries over a 3-month period when he was 21 years old. He was offered two alternative plea deals. The trial judge explained to him that the deals and that he faced up to 490. Hey, they downgraded from the 490 down to 292, Larry. That's not a bad deal. He faced up to 490 years imprisonment if he went to trial. He rejected the plea offer and went to trial. And a jury convicted him on 12 of the counts of burglary in the second degree, 10 counts of burglary in the third degree, theft of a credit card, unlawful means of transportation, and an attempted unlawful means of transportation. Does this mean like carjacking?
Probably not. I wasn't able to get a lot of detail from the Arizona court decision, but he probably just stole their vehicles after he burgled them.
And so then the jury also found two or more aggravating circumstances on all but two counts of convictions. I know you people will say he should have taken the plea.
Well, I might or I might not. It was, again, not clear what they had offered him, and it would depend on what they offered him.
Offered him concurrent.
Well, if they offered him something that would allow him to be free again, which he will now die in prison, barring any changes in Arizona law. But had they offered him anything that would give him some reasonable assurance of freedom, then I would look at the strength of the case as it existed, and he had confessed. That was in the Arizona State Court decision that I reviewed. So being that he had confessed, I would have encouraged him to take a plea that would have gotten him out of prison. Yes, but not knowing what the plea offer was, I don't know if I can say that.
At sentencing, the trial judge found that Petsalis was a Category 3 repetitive offender because he had two prior felony convictions. The judge also considered Petsalis' lack of empathy for his victims, that his victims included elderly, retired people, and that his crimes were premeditated, that he was not under the influence during the commission of any of his crimes, and that his prior incarcerations had not deterred him from continuing to engage in criminal conduct. Why didn't they merge the counts, though? That's really troubling.
Well, because there was no plea agreement, which left sentencing pretty much wide open. The judge rejected Petsalis' argument that the 25 offenses were part of a continuous spree because he committed them over 3 months, which is what he was arguing, exactly what you're saying. They should merge. It was one criminal episode. But the judge said that that gave him plenty of time to reflect upon his conduct and not to continue. So therefore, they didn't merge because the law in Arizona is structured the way it was, and he had nothing to protect him at sentencing because he went to trial. Remember, he did what you encourage everybody to do.
And before we go much further, I would like to get an explanation on why this case went to federal court. If he wasn't robbing houses in multiple states, which I still think wouldn't be federal, how does he end up that Arizona bumped this up and had him tried as in the federal court?
Well, it ends up there because of the U.S. Constitution. There's a procedure after everything's been exhausted in the state that you can argue in federal court that your U.S. constitutional rights were violated. And the federal courts can overturn a state court conviction using habeas corpus as the mechanism or vehicle.
And so in other countries, Larry, they have almost like caps on the number of years. You could go almost like, I don't want to use super gross terms. There was a guy like in the early 90s that he went and did a massive killing spree in maybe Sweden, Switzerland, Finland, somewhere up that way. And his maximum sentence was like 21 years. And he killed like 50 or 60 people. And I know that he did not get out of prison because they kept extending it. But the initial sentence was that he could only receive like a max. Apparently, the United States does not have any sort of maximum.
Well, some states do. But again, this is bright red Arizona.
And I read that when he went to trial, and this means that he would have had a right to have his conviction reviewed by a state appellate court.
That is correct. Yep. But the Arizona Court of Appeals rejected his constitutional claims. They concluded that the extremely lengthy sentence should be assessed based on each individual conviction and sentence, not the cumulative effect of the consecutive sentences. As a result, they found that none of Petsalis' individual sentences were disproportionate.
Oh, so individually. So if we did 25 divided by 292, he got, 15-ish years for each one. So that's not on their own an unreasonable amount of time for each one, but then they would only evaluate. Well, we'll evaluate this one, 15 years, no big deal. Let's look at the next one, 15 years, no big deal. And then they just go down the line. And so 25 times they say 15 years, no big deal. Did he appeal that decision to the Arizona Supreme Court?
He did, and they denied review.
Oh my God. So then he sought to have habeas relief under 28 U.S. Code Statute 2254. Did I read that right?
Section 2254, but that's great.
Darn it! I'll get it right eventually. I remember you people have talked about AEDPA, which is the Anti-Something Terrorism and Protection Act or something. Execution and Death... What is it again? ADPA?
Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act.
Okay. And so we've talked about AEDPA in the past, and you've indicated that the petitioner must exhaust all state court remedies before going into federal court. Does the Arizona Court of Appeals decision meet the definition of exhaustion?
Yes, because the state Supreme Court denied review.
And so he filed the 2254. And what is that a subsection? Is that what you said it was?
Yes, it's the section of the federal law that governs habeas corpus proceedings filed by those challenging some aspect of their conviction on a federal constitutional ground, and they're challenging a state conviction. So that's the section of federal law they use.
I see. And so you said the reasons we are covering this is because of AEDPA. Can you briefly explain what that it does and what it is and what it does and all that?
Sure. The Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 was passed by Congress to deter terrorism, provide justice for victims, provide for an effective death penalty, and for other purposes. To accomplish this goal, some of AEDPA provisions include increasing penalties for crimes involving explosives or terrorism and providing restitution for victims of terrorism and setting new legal procedures for capital cases. That's one part of AEDPA.
And there was a provision in the AEDPA that severely restricts federal judges in terms of their authority to overturn state court convictions. Can you briefly explain that?
Yes, and I borrowed this from Cornell University Law. The AED habeas provisions, as codified as 22 U.S. Code Section 2254, include a statute of limitations for habeas corpus claims and restrictions on a habeas petitioner's ability to file a second habeas petition. And Section 2254D narrowed the grounds on which successful habeas claims can be made, allowing claims only to succeed when the state court decisions, listen carefully, one, was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States, or two, was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in the state court proceeding. So it's pretty narrow. You've got to be able to cite to a U.S. Supreme Court precedent.
All right, so this is making a little bit more sense. His primary argument to the habeas judge was that there should have been no deference to the Arizona Court of Appeals. Did I get that right?
You did. He argued that AEDPA, the deferential standard of review, does not apply to the Arizona Court of Appeals decision because that court did not consider the cumulative impact of his sentence. He argued that he was entitled to a de novo, which means a new review of this claim without any deference.
And the district court disagreed and afforded ADPA deference to the Arizona court and concluded that Petzalis is not entitled to relief. What did the Ninth Circuit decide?
They agreed and affirmed the district court.
All right, well, then let's get more into his AEDPA deference. Without that nuance in the AEDPA, the federal habeas court could have granted him some relief?
That is correct. But now they have this tough standard. And according to the Ninth Circuit, and I'm going to read from what they said, a decision is not objectively unreasonable just because it is incorrect or even clearly erroneous. And they cited some cases that support that. And that is, then they go on to say, that is, even a strong case for relief does not mean a state court's contrary conclusion was unreasonable. And then they cited Harrington versus Richter from 2011. So I hope you guys heard what, even if it's incorrect or clearly erroneous, that's not enough.
But don't we want the states to be able to control their own court systems anyway? They're the sovereign, blah, blah, blah. So they can't. You don't just want the federal government to go in and overrule everything.
That is correct. That's what the conservatives used as an argument for this particular section when they did the habeas insertion into the AEDPA 96. They argued that these lifetime appointed judges who are accountable to no one come in and just steamroll these state courts with the vast power of the federal government, letting vicious criminals go free on the flimsiest of grounds, and that we needed to have finality with the state courts unless there was some astronomically absurd thing that went wrong. And it's just almost impossible to thread the needle through the AEDPA.
Doesn't 292 say something about something completely egregious?
No, that's what the will of the people is.
I see. All right. Well, and I read through this Arizona Court of Appeals did not specifically rule on the constitutionality of the 292 years, which he argued was cumulatively cruel, and unusual. It is certainly unusual, Larry.
It is. He did indeed argue that. He presented an Eighth Amendment claim and a state constitutional claim to the Arizona courts, asserting that the cumulative impact of his sentences was cruel and unusual because they violated the prohibition against sentences that are disproportionate to the crime committed. But no dice. Cruel and unusual is a tough standard to meet, as if you heard me say over the last 5 years. If putting you in the electric chair is not cruel,
right?
It's hard to imagine anything being cruel and unusual. But I thought about this before we started recording. Now, according to the Scalia doctrine, he says that you should look at the death penalty, for example, was widely used in colonial times. Therefore, no one would have been thinking when they drafted the Constitution that there'd be any prohibition against states having death penalty. He said that. We played it multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well then, by the same token, in colonial times, no one ever got sentenced to any really significant long period of time because, as Scalia pointed out, they got executed. If they did a serious crime, they got executed. So right. Therefore, haven't they done kind of a flip-flop by saying that, because if you're supposed to look at what happened in colonial times, no one would have gotten a 292-year sentence in colonial times. So therefore, if you judge what that clause may have meant based on how it would have been understood at that time, that would have been so absurd, it just would have been heard of. But amazingly, they don't see it that way. They do an about-face when it comes to it.
I mean, since you were alive almost back then, in my brain, we did back then, there was not a whole prison complex with hundreds of employees and all that. So it was almost like, if you're going to get a fairly short sentence for something, you know, you stole some horses, then you're going to get some amount of time and you're going to be a burden on someone for them to take care of you. And then they're going to let you go and possibly say, get out of my town and don't ever come back. But now we have this whole complex, the prison industrial complex that locks you up indefinitely, essentially.
That is correct. They just executed you back in those times, though.
Right. If you did something that extreme, they would just like, we're not going to deal with you anymore, so we're going to get rid of you.
Well, they executed for ultimate minor crimes back in those days.
And then the court also stated the Arizona Court of Appeals addressed Petzalas's constitutional claims in a subsection of its decision titled Cruel and Unusual Punishment. It discussed Supreme Court precedent addressing sentence proportionality and recognized that Petzalas challenged the cumulative impact of his sentences. But the Arizona Court of Appeals declined to assess the proportionality of Petzalas's sentence on a cumulative basis because of Arizona's prohibition against considering the imposition of consecutive sentences in a proportionality inquiry. Did the state consider his arguments or did they not?
Well, it was a difficult read to follow in that regard, but according to the Ninth Circuit, the Arizona Court of Appeals did, by applying the rule against considering the imposition of consecutive sentences in the proportionality inquiry and considering the facts relevant to sentencing, including the number of victims and his criminal history, they rejected his constitutional claims, both state and federal, challenging his sentence as grossly disproportionate to the crimes.
Let's get out of this case if you are finished. So it's important to read on page 17 of the opinion. It states, there is no clearly established law from the Supreme Court on whether Eighth Amendment sentence proportionality must be analyzed on a cumulative or individual basis when a defendant is sentenced on multiple offenses. And then they went on to say, where the Supreme Court has not addressed an issue in its holding, a state court adjudication of the issue not addressed by the Supreme Court cannot be contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. So, in a nutshell, since the U.S. Supreme Court has not ruled on the issue of cumulative or individual basis, it cannot be a violation of clearly established law. Did I get that right?
You got it absolutely right. They said, since there has been nothing from the high court on this, that it can't be contrary. Now, you have to admit that's actually somewhat rational. If the law says that they can't grant relief unless it's contrary to U.S. Supreme Court decision and precedent, and there is none, it can't be contrary to something that doesn't exist, can it?
No, but we talked about something halfway recently where there wasn't precedent. And it's like, well, if there's no precedent, how do you use precedent? How do you get precedent if there's no precedent?
Well,
I don't remember what it was. It was a couple of 3 months ago or something like that. It was like it would be an impossible standard to meet to get some kind of precedent because there's no precedent.
Well, this case will need to go up to the Supreme Court.
I see. So what's the solution, do you think?
Well, the solution would be to change the AEDPA or the appointment of more activist judges.
Oh, Jesus. We can't do that, Larry. I know you love it when I ask you this. Who appointed the three? Yeah, who appointed the three judges on the panel that did the decision here in the Ninth Circuit? I noticed that Judge Christian dissented and would have provided relief. Did you read her opinion? And who is she?
I did not read her opinion. I skimmed it, but she was one of the three on the panel. And she would have given him relief, but she was appointed by that old liberal named Obama. But Judge Silver was appointed as a district judge by President Ford, and he was elevated to the Court of Appeals by President George H.W. Bush. And then the other appointee, Danielle Forrest, was appointed by President Trump. So the two who voted to sustain the district judge and say the 292 years is okay and that our hands were tied by AEDPA were appointed by Team Red.
And you hate when I ask you about Team Red versus Team Blue, but here you are bringing it up of pointing out, you always have this agenda, Larry, to point out the Team Red is not in our favor.
I'm only pointing out the facts. Now, it's not always the fact, but in this particular case, it is the fact that had there been one more like Judge Christian, we might have had a different outcome.
All righty then. Anything else before we backtrack around to what I messed up in the order?
No, I think this was the correlation was with Stephen May, who has 75 years, and the Ninth Circuit felt, you remember they said that it reflects poorly on the American judicial system, that he would likely die in prison. Well, 75 years is somewhat less than 292. So I wanted people to know it's not just PFRs who get lengthy sentences. I know that you focus on that, but there are a lot of people who get very lengthy sentences, including under three strikes laws and included in consecutive sentencing that's imposed around the country, and particularly in the more conservative states. You would not see anyone sentenced to 292 years in Vermont. It just wouldn't happen. They don't think that way in Vermont. It's like it would never occur to them to put somebody in prison for 300 years.
But, riddle me this no one, including we were talking about the Queen when we first started up, like she would have access to the best medical care on the planet. They have millions and millions and millions of dollars to pay for this, and it's probably just provided for by the state of the royalty there. So, but a person in prison obviously doesn't have access to any of that stuff. How do they give you 292, which was downgraded from 490? There's no way that a 25-year-old, he might live to in his 70s, possibly 80s, being in prison. So, like, just giving the person 100 years would be a death sentence.
Sure.
What's the rationale behind giving you 292?
Well, the district judge said, the trial judge said that he was trying to send a message to the community. But a message could have been far, fully effective with far less than 292 years. You got a 21-year-old. We all know that 21-year-olds generally age out of their propensity to commit criminal acts, particularly economically driven crimes like this. And I think it's just distasteful. But Arizona is a very tough state, and that's what happens. And I suggest anyone, if I've got it right, that it's Kingman, I think it is, you probably ought to stay out of that jurisdiction from the looks of this.
Jeepers. All right. Well, then I'm going to set this up for you. We have four video clips, two little segment A and segment B and four clips, two in each little block. Set this up. What's the first section going to be about?
Well, we're going to be talking about the Maricopa County, Arizona district attorney, state's attorney, county attorney, I forget what they call it, but the prosecuting attorney for that jurisdiction. The election is coming up, of course, in less than 2 months. And I would like to show the type of things that are said in advance of elections and let you, the audience, decide if these are over the top. And this is the current office holder and the challenger. Each one of them are answering the same question and how they choose to communicate with the public. So clip one would be from the person who would like to assume the office in Maricopa County, and her name is Julie Gunnickel.
All right, so here, let's hope all my buttons work.
What is the clearest difference between you and your opponent when it comes to how you would run the county attorney's office?
Sure, Bram. First, choice is on the ballot. Now that Roe v. Wade has fallen and that Arizonans are now subjected to a rule from 1864 that creates a mandatory minimum of 2 years in prison and a max of five for people accessing an abortion, and carries with it a little sister misdemeanor rule that criminalizes even the advertisement of contraceptives, it is so important that we have a county attorney who has committed from the outset to use her discretion to never criminalize people for their reproductive health care decisions. The clearest difference between myself and my opponent is the idea that not now, not ever, we will not use the power of the police and prosecutor's office to invade Maricopa County residents' bedrooms and private lives.
Same question.
Okay, what do you have to say about that, first of all?
Well, I felt, my opinion was that she was clearly communicating that as a prosecutor that she would not enforce the 1864 law that carries a mandatory 2 years in prison. That seems to be a fair question to ask a person who's going to hold the reins of power. And it wasn't exactly the question she was asked, but how she would pick and choose, because prosecutors can't prosecute every single thing that's unlawful, so they have to have some type of screening process. So she clearly told Maricopa County residents and voters that the 1864 laws would not be enforced in Maricopa County if she were elected. That's my reading of that. And then this is the current office holder coming in next, Rachel Mitchell. She has an answer to the same question.
Okay, here's clip number two. And it didn't want to play for me.
Same question for you, Rachel Mitchell. What is the clearest difference between you and Julie Gunnickel?
What is on the ballot, Bram, is the safety of our community. I'm a career prosecutor who has worked with the police throughout my 30-year career. I've spent 25 years protecting women and children. And my philosophy is that we hold people accountable who commits crimes. My opponent, on the other hand, wants to target police officers, has advocated defunding police officers, and also other things such as getting rid of cash bail. Those things are harmful to the community, and they are going to create danger for our citizens.
Did she even answer the question that was asked?
Well, the audience is going to have to be the judge, but I felt like that answer was intended to scare people. She uses that buzzword, defund the police, and no one has ever proposed defunding the police. Ever, ever, ever. But that is a catchy phrase. And she talked about danger to the community. And then the bail reform, the business side of the bail bond industry, is so adamantly opposed to changing the status quo. And they implied that if you don't let us charge people money to get out of jail, that you'll be in danger. Because if they're released under any other system, they've not been properly screened. But we screen them so well with our money. It sounded like to me that was intended to scare the voters of Maricopa County. That's what I heard in that, and that's what I'm trying to point out to people. The voters are barraged with this type of stuff, and they're going to make a decision come November of who they want to run that office in Maricopa County. I doubt that Mitchell will enforce the 1864 law, although she did not renounce it. She had an opportunity to say that she would. I find it doubtful that she will enforce the law, but she didn't really say anything other than, if you elect my opponent, you're going to be unsafe. That's what I heard in that.
Right, totally. So tell me, Larry, that with your political experience, how come no politician anywhere ever answers the question they are asked?
they're trained not to. They're told that you have a message. Their handlers tell them that when you go to this interview with whatever the situation may be, that we want you to hammer this. And so it's just not done. Answering our questions is the silliest thing that you could imagine doing.
Okay, well, then let's move over. Set up the second block of the two clips that we have. One of them's kind of long, the other one's pretty short.
Yes, this is our favorite police sheriff, actually, from Polk County, Florida. And he is proclaiming how proud it is that he arrested, they call this human trafficking. Now, we used to call it prostitution when someone hires for sexual services, but they were running a human trafficking sting, and they caught an interesting individual. And it almost seems to me like he just relishes in bringing this person's career to an end. They had 30 years of law enforcement experience with a Cartersville Police Department, which is in Georgia. So roll the video.
All right.
Well, same question for you, Rachel Mitchell. What is the clearest difference?
What I consider a high-profile arrest. This is Deputy Chief Jason DePrima of the Cartersville Police Department. As I understand it, after talking to his chief, he's been there almost 30 years, graduate of the FBI Academy, well-respected police officer in town. Did you notice I said in town? But he was out of town. That's right, he was at an American Polygraph Association meeting in Orlando, Florida. Let me say this clearly. I don't want you to miss it. Driving an unmarked vehicle that was normally assigned to the DEA task force, meaning their officer assigned to the task force would have driven this vehicle. But apparently his vehicle was not so good to make the trip, so he's in one of the undercover vehicles. When he shows up at our undercover operation in the government vehicle, carrying alcoholic beverages, apparently some Bud Light for himself and White Claw for our undercover operative.
Hey man, what is White Claw? I've never heard of this.
I have not the foggiest notion, but it really makes me have trouble sleeping at night to know that an adult man from Cartersville, Georgia, would go to Polk County, Florida, to hook up with an adult woman, and they would drink alcoholic beverages. I mean, to me,
is there something wrong with doing that? I'm sorry, I haven't been updated on the social conventions. Is this not allowed anymore?
Well, the drinking is certainly lawful, but the paying for sex, he was going to pay the, as the allegation goes, he was hiring this undercover person for a sexual escapade. But now this state is known for its wise fiscal management. They're run by people who proclaim to keep government small and lean and efficient. And this is a solution in search of a problem. This guy was out of town on business, by all accounts, gone to your favorite association of polygraphers.
I was going to bring that up too.
And he was going to have a paid liaison with an adult, and the Polk County Sheriff in Florida is taking great satisfaction. Sheriff Judd does this all the time. He does a press conference about every week or sometimes more about some type of sting, some kind of arrest, and he does this. This is not anything unusual. But folks in Polk County, they obviously support him because he wins re-election, and it just seems like such a waste of resources. But yeah, we got a second clip with Sheriff Judd.
All right. And so here's the second one. This one's pretty short.
His picture at the Polk County Jail. That's right. And let me tell you the story as he relates it to us. He is texting with, guess what, our undercover detective. He started this conversation with her on Wednesday night, where he was going to show up, but he became spooked. He didn't say why. But on Thursday night, he just couldn't resist the urge to be with our undercover detective who he thought was a high-class prostitute.
And you, you like, so we've had a particular guest on 2-3 times, Kathleen, who covers this, like, this is her whole focus in the world, is covering the subject of, like, I mean, it's a natural desire to go have relations with people, attractive, whatever. Like, and so I'm assuming she was a good looking lady, and so he looks like he's a pretty young lad, and okay. But he just wants to berate him, huh?
Well, he does that. That's his standard operation when they put up these nice photos and show. You know, I almost feel bad for the police officer of Cartersville. You know, I mean, I'm not condoning that he should have been doing that, but it's, what is it, the oldest profession that there is?
Yes, I believe that is the oldest profession is prostitution.
So Sheriff Judd has been in office. He was elected in 2004. He received 64% of the race of vote in a three-way race. He basically ran, you might as well say, unopposed in 2008. He had a writing opponent, and he had a write-in opponent in 2012. And so he got 96% of the vote, roughly. Then 2016, he ran for a fourth term, and he got 95% of the vote with another write-in candidate. In 2020, they gave up on challenging him, so he ran unopposed. Apparently, the people in Polk County are very happy with this sheriff. And when I tell you that our people that we elect are a reflection of us, Sheriff Judd gets on the camera and wins 95% of the vote because that's who the people are in Polk County. They're happy with this.
I still wonder, Larry, in the grand scheme of things, why, similar to marijuana, why wouldn't we legalize it, regulate it, make sure that it's safe? Then you don't have the underground economy. There's a whole lot of black market stuff that would go on. There's going to then be drug deals and the people extorted. If we made it something of a legitimate profession, then seems like that would go away.
Well, oddly enough, there is an organization, I can't recall the name, but it was at one of the conferences I attended in Las Vegas, and I got a shirt, a t-shirt from them about sex workers and making their life better. But it's not likely to happen because of a number of things. We have such a bias for, there's a morality bias about sex in this country, and a lot of it's based on biblical, that it's supposed to be between man and wife and for procreation. Right. And beyond that, then you've, it's morphed into, it's human trafficking now. They've so expanded the definition of human trafficking that everything that used to be unlawful under one section of law has now been transformed to be a more serious crime. It's human trafficking. So now that's what this was, a human trafficking operation. And at the beginning of the video, he says we were looking for victims of human trafficking. And in that process, they have to arrest the Johns to find out if they're victimizing people.
And there was no, it was an undercover cop. So, I mean, I guess he could have said, yes, I will pay you for the deed. And so I guess that means there was intent and whatever they have stuff. But there's technically no victim. It's not like there was a worker on the other side of that. There was never going to be any illegal activities.
Well, other than the pay for sex, which he got the price confused, according to Sheriff Judd. He was confused about how much he owed for it, but he did agree. He did agree, and he brought money. And then there was another part I didn't ask you to do the clip, but he apparently, according to Sheriff Judd, the detective from Cartersville, he apparently had been swindled by someone for $200. They told him to go get a card and make a picture of it. And I think you can figure out the rest of what would happen. He had to buy the card to show that he had the money and make a picture of it. And you can figure out what went with the card after they got the number.
Okay. Jeepers, man. Well, I think that's all we have. And it's pretty much about the time limit for the show anyway. Is there anything else to cover here before we skedaddle? I have an announcement that I want to make that I'm going to ask your permission to make the announcement about it first.
Well, if you're going to ask it live with thousands of people listening, what choice do I have?
Well, that's, I already asked you in pre-show if you would do it, if you would entertain communications with people. there. Was that vague enough?
That's vague enough, yes.
Okay. And you agree?
I agree. We're going to try to expand the reach of FYP, particularly if our transcription service, we've got a new person trying to do the transcript, did a great job for the first episode, so we'll see how that goes. But if I can free up some time.
So what we're going to do is I will create a new voice channel on the Discord server, and we'll start it out pretty low, Larry, like maybe at the $5 a month level, if you are at that level. And I don't know what the schedule is going to be, so I'm going to have to figure out how to coordinate with you to make an announcement. But you will go into that voice channel, and if you want to talk to Larry about anything you want to, I'm sure that you'll put limits on whatever they want to. But if you want to shoot the shit with Larry, then you can go in there and kick it with him and talk about stuff. And maybe it'll be an hour, 2 hours, depending on how long Larry can put up with you people.
You people, huh?
You people.
All right.
Is that a fair way to announce it?
That sounds great.
Perfect. Well, then, without anything else to do, that is going to conclude this episode of the Fine Registry Matters podcast produced by FYP Education. Somebody asked that. I still don't know what this is. Man, look. Go look in our archives, whatever you want to do. You can go find where it is. I'm not telling you what it is. So you can find all the show notes over at registrymatters.co or at FYP Education is where you'll find the transcripts produced by our fine new person. And, so then you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. And email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And if you want to join in on the new chatting with Larry, it will be, make sure you sign up at the $5 a month level, and that's patreon.com/registrymatters. And I think that's all I have for the night, Larry. And I hope that you have a splendid, fantastic rest of your weekend. And I will talk to you soon.
Thanks. I'll see you in a week or so.
All right, buddy. Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.